I just don't even have the words to say how much value I think it brings when women stand together and love and support each other. I think that's where really beautiful things can happen.
And exhausted from living a life of aimlessly going through the motions? When we are living this way, it's easy to feel that our lives lack meaning. But that sentiment couldn't be further from the truth. Dear friend, so much of what you're hoping for is already right in front of you. You just might need some inspiration from the stories and conversations of everyday women who are unique and also share things in common with you. Welcome to The Commons with Carla. Join us as we learn, grow, and connect to create lives and homes where our moments and relationships are overflowing with purpose and intention. If you are a listener who skips the outro of this podcast when you listen, you may have missed something I say on every episode. Your story matters. Humans are storytellers. We learn through story. We connect through story. We honor and love one another when we slow down, are present with, and get to know each other through our stories. My guest today agrees, and I can't wait for you to hear not only her story, but how her work helps other women's voices to rise. Today on the show, I am in conversation with Gretchen Heishkens. Gretchen is on mission to alleviate poverty using fashion as a force for good. Like each of us, her journey to get here was not a straight line, and she's not done. Her mama heart led her to start a charity, an orphanage in Haiti. Her experiences gave her a front row seat to the real problems and led to a perspective shift. With her new worldview, she co-founded Trades of Hope. She and her team continue to see women rise out of poverty, trafficking, and gender inequality. Gretchen also authored a book called Our Voices Rising, One CEO's Journey to Alleviate Poverty Using Fashion as a Force for Good. It's excellent, a wonderful memoir and tribute to women globally who share a common desire for family and purposeful lives. I highly recommend you read it and discuss it with your friends. As you listen to Gretchen, hear how her unique experiences make her perfect to lead this effort, and consider how your unique story has led to your perfect vocation. I'm Carla Osorno, and this is The Commons with Carla, episode 138. Gretchen, welcome to the Commons.
Oh, thank you so much, Carla. I'm so happy to be here.
I am thrilled that you're here. It's very nice to meet you. And Melanie, who is part of your team at Trades of Hope, introduced me and told me that you were amazing and that you had written this fabulous book that I needed to read. And guests or listeners, you'll remember that Melanie was a guest back in episode 87 and 97. And I loved my conversation with her. We talked a lot about empowering women and just some amazing things that we talked about. So I was introduced to Trades of Hope and it was an amazing thing. We're going to be talking, you and I, about that today. I also read your excellent book and loved it so much. Oh,
well, thank you. That is very kind. I feel like everybody's time and, you know, the energy they put forth into things, it's valuable. And so I just always really appreciate hearing that. So thank you.
Yeah, I loved it. And from the get, your dedication you put in two parts. And I wanted to start with that. The first part is to all women who find joy in seeing other women rise. I read that and I'm like, I'm going to love this book. If that's how she starts, I'm going to love this book. And I did. It was awesome. But every woman listening, and is my belief, and I shared this with you, is that those early years are kind of a foundation that set us up. And really, whether we live in a home that has some dysfunction and instability, or whether we live in a safe and loving home like you did, there's it sets up for our future calling and our purpose. I really truly believe that God creates us with this inherent nature to do things, and then our nurture kind of shapes that further. So I want to start with your early life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Mid, Michigan. So very much a middle class, I used to think incredibly boring family. And now I look at it and realize like what a blessing that was, right? This boring, predictable, safe family was truly a gift. And like you mentioned, I, you know, I mean, there's no way that our journeys don't shape us. And sometimes it's the really hard stuff that shapes us. And in my case, honestly, I think it was a lot of the stability, that foundation that was laid in my, you know, Midwestern Christian home that really allowed me and gave me the space to dream big and you know, think I can do crazy things, because why not? Right? Like, everybody can. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what a gift. And you went on to just have to take that foundational learning into your life. Were you an only child? I know from your book, but tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, I have one biological brother. And then my parents did divorce when I was almost out of high school. And so I ended up with three really awesome stepsisters as well. So we do have a bigger, more diverse family now, which is really nice. And I enjoy. So yeah, and tons of nieces and nephews who I love. So really fun.
So as I was reading, I was just imagining you just like hanging out in the woods and doing all of these fun things. You also lived very close to your grandparents. Do I remember that right?
Yeah. They lived right on the other side of this beautiful pond that my grandfather actually had created. And so, yeah, I could walk back and forth and go see grandma during the middle of the day. And my brother and I grew up, you know, running around the woods, and I would make him play house out in the woods with me, and, you know, like all of this crazy stuff that, you know, and unfortunately doesn't happen everywhere all the time, especially nowadays. So it was a very wholesome childhood looking back on it now.
Yeah. Surrounded by family, which I think factored into your future calling as well. So one of the scenes that is vivid in my mind, I can just imagine you as a teenager dancing in front of the mirror and thinking about what you wanted to do. And in your book, you described that there were three things that you wanted to do in your life.
Yes. There were just certain things that to me, it was, you know, a no-brainer. Yeah. We lived in the town where Dow Chemical was founded. And so I always thought that that was like so big and sparkly and so cool, right? Like now that I know more about it, it's very controversial, but that's a different story for a different day. So it, that whole idea of this international company and I just wanted for sure to be a part of that. Even from a young age, I don't know why. The idea of dressing up and, you know, fancy quote unquote clothes, of which I of course avoid now. And you know, going to work with all these international people and things, that was really, really exciting. And, I almost forgot what the other one was, but yeah, it was a captain of my cheerleading pom-pom squad. It was pom-pom squad at school. And the other thing was adopting a child. Mm-hmm. And, all three of those things happened.
And I thought it was so special and cool because I really believe in values. And I think that, again, God gives us these core values at the get, and then our environment nurtures those. And in what you described, there was an element of, I mean, evangelism. There was like sharing people, like not evangelism just in the Christian sense, but in telling people, sharing your enthusiasm for something, I guess, in that role as and leadership was in there. The idea of like you said, dressing up and making a difference as part of an organization. Just the sense of a family, like all of that was just in there. Like you could just, as I read that scene, I was just, I don't know Gretchen at all, but I can just see her and see her values just in those three dreams. So I love that scene. I think it just really is telling about who you are. You also talked about Father Tom and what he taught you. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear about a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't realize it at the time because it was the only church I had ever gone to. Right. And we had different priests over different periods, but there was one particular priest and he, I think, was a little bit out of the box thinking actually, as far as Catholicism goes. And, just some things he said to me have always really resonated and really allowed for a close relationship with God as a creator and as, you know, the one that guides us in our life. And so I think that there wasn't a lot of focus on like memorized prayer. I mean, of course you had to memorize a few for catechism, but it was really, he really, you know, brought this idea of really just talking to God throughout your day and your life. And yeah. And so I think that was, he had a huge impact on me. And I wish, I mean, I don't even know what his last name is. No idea if, you know, what has become of him. But yeah, I wish I could tell him that. Thank you for that, because that was truly a gift.
Well, I doubt he listens to the Commons with Carla, but I think it's beautiful that on our journeys, we can make an impact on people and even never even know the ending of it. And yeah, I'm sure. I hope he feels that he is making an impact wherever Father Tom is. But like you said, you did all of those things. So kind of a teaser to the rest of the story. And I don't want to tell everyone about the details yet. I want them to read your book for details. But you did meet your husband. So it's a good thing you went to Dow. And But the second part of your dedication is to my husband, Fritz, my children, Elizabeth, Harrison, and Mia. My granddaughter, is it Kira?
Yes.
And my mom, Jane. I am who I am because of you. And so I'd love for you to tell us one fact about each of those people. Like, what's a fun fact about Fritz?
Fritz is just incredibly supportive. Like, all of the crazy ideas I have had and, you know, done, and oh, I'm going to go fly to Haiti now, and I think we should adopt a child. And, you know, I honestly, I think Fritz would have been fine having no children. It would have just been us living our lives. But I wanted one baby, and then I wanted another baby, and then I wanted to adopt. And, you know, just really super, super supportive in every way.
That's a fun fact about Elizabeth. Yeah,
Elizabeth runs Traits of Hope with me, and she's in some ways very different than I am and looks at the world differently, which it just makes it fun, right? She teaches me things now and, in, you know, challenges me to think about things in different ways. So that's been really good. Harrison, the girls always say that I love him the most, and, you know, all the boy, and well, he's just very lovable. I love that kid. So, I tell them it depends on the day, which one of you I love the most, because it changes, you know. he has always been so thoughtful of me and my feelings and everything. Mia, we did adopt from Haiti, and Mia is, has a very, like, if you do the personality tests, she has a very different personality than the four of us. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with DISC.
Yes.
We are all very strong Ds. And when I learned about DISC, I'm like, oh, poor Mia. Mia is an S for sure. And so she is just a different little bird, and, you know, and she's sweet, and yeah, and she's still very much growing and maturing herself. She did have a baby, Kira. Kira is 2 now, and I'm trying to get her to call me Gigi, but she calls me Juju. So, and I always think of the candy, you know, like a jujube. Yeah. So, and when I say, you know, Kira, can Gigi help you with that? She looks at me like, who are you talking about?
You're Juju.
I think Juju's sticking. Yep. Think Juju's sticking. And then, yeah, my mom has always been there for me and just really supportive and loving and, just created that space where I could be whatever I decided I wanted to be. And that was good. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for satisfying my curiosity about that. Cause when I read that dedication, I'm like, I want to know more. I want to know more about these people. And absolutely, in your book, you did share a lot about them, but it's fun to hear it live. So you are a busy, busy woman, and I know you travel a lot, and you also have deep friendships, and you also have this amazing business, and then you authored a book. So I thought we would use your book to kind of shape our conversation a little bit, because you write about all of these things in it. And the book is called Our Voices Rising, One CEO's Journey to Alleviate Poverty Using Fashion as a Force for Good. And so telling. It's just, I mean, I saw that title. I love the front image on the book. I love so much about this book. I'm going to be just totally raving the whole time. But in the book, you talk about that, and we know from just what you said today that you decided early on that adoption was important to you. Mm-hmm. And you followed through on that teen promise to yourself. So I'd love to hear just a little bit about how that started for you. Like, when did you know it was the right time, and where did you choose to go? A little bit. Again, I think I know some of the story, but listeners, tease them so that they want to go find more.
it was a journey, and I think probably hormones kicked in at some point, and I wanted another baby, you know, yes. Like the third baby, and but knew that that baby didn't need to come from me. You know, knowing that there are children all over the world who needed parents. And, you know, we started looking in our own backyard. And I think at the time I was young and a little afraid of the whole foster care system, and thought that international adoption would be easier and safer. And, you know, having gone through it, I don't think that's true now, but, because it was a hard journey at times, but yeah, that's where we started. You know, I started looking into different countries at different times. And then, yes, friends of my sister's were going on this trip to a Mother Teresa orphanage in Haiti. And like so many, I grew up really admiring Mother Teresa as well, and kind of, you know, painting that as probably some romanticized picture in my head. But I went and got a really big dose of reality as to what it is, you know, to be in Haiti, for one thing. I didn't even really know where I was going. And then to experience that for a week and to have these really hard lessons every day.
What did you witness there that was hard? Because you do say that it was eye-opening, to say the least.
Yeah. So we, you know, even just the first morning walking there, we left the, you know, the small, I don't know, I guess you call it a B&B, but basically just a house that someone had opened up with some bunk beds in it, right? And on the walk there, we crossed over what is sometimes a riverbed, and there was a little bit of water running into it, in it, and there were women washing, and there were babies playing in it, and there were pigs running around in it, and trash everywhere. And I mean, things that we never, ever would have let our kids play in, or, you know,
yeah,
they were fetching water out of it. So that was kind of the first morning, right? Like, oh, yeah. Wow. All the smells and the sounds and the dust and from the busy streets. And yeah, so that was kind of a good first dose. And then, yeah, to see people bring in the really sick babies. I mean, like babies that would be in the NICU for sure here in the United States are kind of just hopefully going to get better. You know, I mean, they were in this Mother Teresa orphanage, and some of them would have an IV or something, but basically it was just through prayer, the best of intentions, some formula, you know, let's see what we can do kind of thing. And, and watching the parents come in, and they're searching for their child to see if their child's even still there. Cause at that point they could only visit once a week. And so, you know, seeing mothers come in looking frantically for their babies and then finding their baby, and they would burst into tears, and it was, it was really something, you know. And then seeing these women praise God that their child is still alive and hopefully looking better. I can't imagine as a mom, you know, that you get to the place where your child is starving to death. They're so, so sick. And you just kind of hand the baby over to this orphanage and kind of hope for the best, you know, and then just go back next week and see what happened. And these women were, men were walking, you know, miles and miles and miles to get there.
Yeah. And I think that was what was surprising to me, is that there were moms visiting them every week. Like, when you think about an orphanage, you think about the parents are out of the picture, and that's why the children are there. And so when you talked about the difference between orphans and poverty orphans, it was, I guess I maybe was naive about that and just the prevalence of that.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah, definitely. So the top part, the upper floor, was an orphanage, like purely abandoned children, some tiny, tiny babies that had been found out in random places. And then some were given to the orphanage, I believe, through Haitian Social Services, who were found abandoned. But then that bottom floor, there were some abandoned children, but most of the children had parents there. So the bottom floor really functioned as a hospital. So, and I really went into that not even really understanding that whole portion of it. So, yeah. So to see these little ones so, so sick, and, you know, what the sisters were doing there to just try and show them love and take care of them the very best they could was heartbreaking and absolutely beautiful, kind of all in the same breath, you know?
Yeah. And so at the end of that trip, you flew back home, but that experience shifted something in you. So what happened? Because you didn't just go back home and then resume life as it had been. What happened?
I was kind of shell-shocked, I think, for a little while. I went home, jumped back into life. You know, a friend of mine was getting married. So like the next day I had to go to a really cute little tea party as a, you know, her bridal shower. And people kept asking me, how was the trip? I'm like, I don't even know yet. Like, I can't even talk about this quite yet, you know? And then it just took a few weeks settling back into real life, really kind of praying about it and thinking about, you know, what did we want and what do we want to see happen? And then a bunch of research looking at other orphanages. My husband and I both grew up Catholic, but we weren't practicing Catholics at that point. And so we couldn't even adopt from Mother Teresa Orphanage if we wanted to. So we just started looking at other orphanages. And yeah, unfortunately, there were and are way too many in Haiti. So finding an orphanage is not a hard thing to do there. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And then we started one adoption and that fell through. And that was super heartbreaking for me. I thought for sure this little girl was meant to be our daughter. And, but it turned out that Mia was meant to be our daughter. And so, after, you know, about 18 months of the process there, we did end up bringing Mia home with us. So beautiful.
Yeah. But your relationship with Haiti continued. Talk about that.
Yeah. So even before we met Mia, you know, during that process of getting to know these other orphanages, it just became really obvious that so many were so corrupt and they were in it for all the wrong reasons. And I felt like every time I went to Haiti, it was another big dose of reality. And God really showed like a whole scenario that I never could have dreamt up myself, you know? And, at some point, you know, this other woman, Vanessa and I, we, after a very tearful, stressful day, you know, we're sitting, we were filthy from the dust and from the tears and, you know, this traumatic day. And, we're sitting in this beautiful restaurant in Haiti because they do have them, or they used to, at least. It's pretty bad right now, but, and we just thought, you know what? I thought at least, I don't know how to start an orphanage in Haiti, but I know we can do it better than anything I've seen here so far. And there are so many kids that need care. Like, let's just do it and, you know, provide the best care we can for these little ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Not
a lot of people would do that. And I think that's why I really wanted people to hear your story, because if that had happened, I don't know that I would do that. But you, when you have an idea, you start to take action on it. And you said it, you said when you were young, because of that foundation and that safety that you grew up in, you could dream big. And then you just knew that anything was possible by taking an action. And so I know it wasn't easy, but you opened an orphanage, ran an orphanage, then opened a school and then a medical clinic. And you did all of this for 8 years.
Yeah. And there was really no end in sight. So the orphanage, you know, started off really small and kind of just kept growing. You know, I think we got up to 28 kids. And again, our goal was to provide good care. And so that was never the intention, but it's hard to say no to the need that is there. And then the school was kind of one of my most favorite things ever, like seeing all these kids come into school. And in Haiti, as in many countries in the world, school is a safe haven. You know, it's a place, yes, to get an education, but it's also a safe place to spend your days and to grow as, you know, as a person and to have other educated people pouring into you. Yeah, I absolutely loved the school. And then my sister is a nurse practitioner. And so she pulled together some of her good friends who are medical professionals. And I really just provided a space for the medical clinic. But I loved that it was there because then we would have people, you know, the parents and the kids from the school. That was already hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, were getting access to medical care where most likely they wouldn't have had that access at all. So,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
It was fun.
So you would have continued doing it, but for an event that took place.
Yeah.
So talk about that experience and how, yeah, nature intervened.
Yeah, it sure did. You know, I had learned about microfinancing and I had taken too many babies that mothers had handed to me. Just knowing this is not the best solution, but I just didn't know what else to do. Like if we didn't, you know, agree to take care of this baby, she was just going to go find another orphanage. And so, you know, learned a lot, would do it differently if, you know, if we were starting again, which we're not, we're definitely, you know, I wanted to figure out a way to prevent these children from becoming orphans, you know, because it doesn't matter how great your building or your staff is, like, an orphanage is an orphanage, and the nannies switch out and they go home each day to their own families. And oh my goodness, at 5 o'clock, the crying that would start from certain kids as their nannies left them. Mm-hmm. And it was just horrible. And so, I mean, the night nurses would come in, but it, you know, it was just not as it's supposed to be, obviously. Right. And I just really wanted to find a way to help these women who, in most cases, really loved these kids. They just could not feed any more people in their families, you know, so sad. And so fell in love with this idea of microfinancing, like helping women create jobs or create a job for themselves, you know, build a little business of some sort. And thought that eventually Three Angels, the group that we started, would move into that. But really, we were so up to our eyeballs and just trying to fundraise, make sure the orphanage had, you know, the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars it needed every month and the school and whatever. And I said something to my board about, you know, microfinancing and we should start this program. And they're like, don't even talk to us about that, Gretchen. Like, you've got to be kidding. And they were kind of right. I mean, we would have needed God to really dump something in our laps that made sense. We also had no background in that. And that's something that needs to come with a lot of education as well to the participants in any program. And so I just didn't know how we were ever going to pivot to something else because the orphanage was my responsibility. Like literally on paper in Haiti, all those 28 kids were my responsibility. And that was super stressful, obviously.
Yeah.
and in all honesty, like it got to the point where it was almost laughable isn't the right word, but like you just had to chuckle every month. God would drop some random money from somewhere in our lap, but it was always just enough.
Yes.
You know, every month,
just in time too.
And just in time. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that was good, but there was no space. There was no wiggle room. There was no saving anything so that you could start a new program and whatever. And kind of, in my opinion, get to the root of the problem much more than an orphanage, you know? And so I couldn't have ever come up with an idea of how I would not have an orphanage in Haiti because it was always, the kids were, you know, it was taking years and years to get adoptions done at that point. like 3+ years. Oh, wow. And then you would end up with new little kids in your orphanage. And so it was, kind of this never ending story. And then the earthquake happened one day. And, you know, that was 2010. And so traumatic, so awful. So many people lost so many people they loved. And it was obviously really, really horrible. Yes. But we were able to go down less than a week after it happened. My intention was to take cash, make sure the kids had food, water. You know, you have to buy everything in Haiti. It's just as expensive as here in the United States, probably more so now even. But I just needed to make sure they were okay. And I needed to find a place for them to stay because our building had huge cracks. Like you could pass notes or quarters through it, you know, the walls. So I needed to figure that out. And so we went down, and the night before we went down, one gentleman that I was traveling with says, we go to sit down to have dinner, and he said, and he basically starts praying, and he prays that we can bring all the kids back. And I'm like, yeah, right. Like, what do you mean bring all the kids back? What are you talking about? You know? Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, just a couple of days later, they all had humanitarian parole. They were all in the process of being adopted by families in Canada and the United States. And when we brought them all home, and all of a sudden I didn't have an orphanage and some of these kids who would have been waiting for this adoption process, even in the best of circumstances, for years, they got to go home to their families. So some of them were little babies even and stuff. So instead of being a toddler by the time you, you know, got your family. Yeah. So some silver linings amongst a lot of tragedy.
Yeah. I was bawling my eyes out and reading those stories. Ah, but so, so happy that they got to go to their forever homes when they did.
Yeah. Totally miraculous.
Yeah. Okay. So basically a day, the orphanage is no more. So you had to make a decision to rebuild or to pivot. Mm-hmm. We know the end of the story because Trades of Hope exists. But talk about what that was like for you.
Yeah, obviously I had a huge emotional attachment to Three Angels. And Three Angels is still operating today. And they have, you know, I think they've cycled through a couple different board of directors over the past 14 years. And that's not a bad thing. And I just knew, I know what happens when you start a small orphanage. It's really hard not to build into a bigger orphanage. And so I didn't want to do that. I really wanted, there are so many orphanages in Haiti, and I really wanted to help prevent orphans. I really wanted to help moms keep their babies. And so I started talking, you know, on these like three-way calls at that point. With some of our board members. And this is after the kids are home. We've all taken a breath. It's probably a week or so after, you know, we have no orphanage. And I said to them, well, I think it's time to start our microfinancing program now. Let's start learning about it, right? Start researching, start creating a plan. And they all said, okay, but we'll just open a small baby house. I'm like, I mean, like, I was so sure that that is not where God was calling me. Like, I felt like I had had 8 years worth of lessons, and I darn well better have learned from them. Otherwise, I'm back in that same situation again, you know? Right. And so I just decided, okay, well, if you guys want the small baby house, I'm done. And I knew that my friend would keep the school going. And because I definitely loved the school so much. And so, and Three Angels did. They have a bigger, better school even now. And they have a small baby house, and they managed to keep it small. So something I could not do. I think I have a problem saying no. And so that gave me the space then to, like, I just handed everything over, and I just realized my time with Three Angels was done, which was strange because I would have thought that I would have ran Three Angels for the rest of my life, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That gave the space to really start looking at, you know, what does God want us to do in this next season of life? And how can we positively impact the world for women and children and keep families together?
Yeah.
And that's what led to Trades of Hope.
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew from what you had experienced and that the answer was in creating jobs for these women so that they would have opportunities and they would be able to feed their families. And yeah, so how did it go from microfinancing, easy for me to say, to a direct sales company?
Yeah, kind of weird. But, you know, I started reading more books about microfinancing. I started to realize, wow, we really need to have educated people on the ground because you need to really create a really strong structure because you are helping people, ideally, helping people, many of which are totally illiterate, run a business. And for anybody who has ran a business of any size, shape, there's a lot to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, about reinvesting your money and saving your money and paying back the microfinancing loan. And there's something really beautiful in it, but it is not easy at all. And when I think about, you know, how some of the women that I had met and spent time with over the years, and even like moms I know now, right? Like, they're just trying to survive and they're up to their eyeballs. And if you ask them if they wanted to start a business, you're like, are you crazy? No, I don't want to start a business. I want to pay my bills and feed my kids. And, you know, so there's a lack of some practicality in microfinancing. I still think it has a place. It's awesome. I hear great stories about it, but in a way, sometimes people just need a job. In a safe, healthy place where they're getting paid a fair wage. One thing we hear a lot in our artisan groups is how much it means to them to come together and basically create this sisterhood within their own artisan groups, something that some of them have never had before. And so, depending on the culture, and that has been a truly beautiful thing, you know, and what's cool about, you know, the women who are making the products for Trades of Hope is many times there's a very entry level job, whether that is putting beads on a string, you know? Mm-hmm. So you can learn as you go, you know? Yeah. And I think that's really cool. Like some of the women that, we have seen really rise up over the last, you know, decade, and completely change. Of course, we're all kind of growing up together during this time. They needed a safe, calm working environment where they could just roll beads or string beads or, you know, to get themselves back together a little bit. Mm-hmm. And now they're doing even much more, you know. Sometimes, these groups, we've really seen women thrive and grow and, you know, be in inventory management and get Microsoft certifications and learn how to do photography and learn how to, you know, be a part of the quality control department. And some women just want to keep stringing beads and there's nothing wrong with that, you know? So, I think that these workshops that Trades of Hope has been so privileged to work with over the years, are just a really beautiful place for women to be able to learn how to thrive and really create the lives that they want to see. Because that's the thing with charity, right? Charity has people helping with the best of intentions. And sometimes charity is super necessary, right? But a lot of times, especially in years past, charities would decide what people needed and what people wanted. And I love that fair trade, that, you know, through ethically made products, I see women and some men learning and growing and then choosing how they want to see their lives for themselves, for their kids, for, you know, their families and as a whole. And yeah, that's been really beautiful.
I agree. Just learning more about Trades of Hope and what you all are doing. It is beautiful. There's so much dignity in how you respond to people and how you choose your partners and just how I love, because I love stories, how you allow them to tell their own stories. And you're not, that's one of the things, like you're listening to them and allowing them to use their own voices to tell their stories and not assuming that you know what they need. It's just so disrespectful to, and absolutely, you're right. There are tragic situations where immediate help is necessary, and you have to just help because it's hard to make a decision when you're have been traumatized.
Yeah.
But for the long haul, and you even say that, like, this is a long game. Like, this is not mm-hmm. something that immediately changes families, but by investing in women and allowing them to invest in their future, it's such a beautiful thing, and it changes them. It changes their families. It changes communities. Like, it's just has this ripple effect that is so incredibly beautiful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. So how do you choose your work groups or your artisan partners? What goes into that? What do you consider?
Well, initially, it's kind of a hodgepodge. They come different ways from different people in different situations. So some of them are long-term established fair trade groups. Especially fair trade has been a thing in India since the 40s. I mean, really. And, you know, so there are some groups that have been around for decades, and it has been fun to grow with them and to really realize that we can help them make a difference in their groups as well. And then there are other groups that started the same time we did. You know, one of my all-time favorite groups is always will be one in Haiti. And I met this woman via some friends from all of our time in Haiti. And her name is Shelly. And she's just, you know, out to advocate and work yeah. so hard to just continuously over the past 14 years, try and help these people in these horrible situations have jobs, have an income, and take care of their family. And so that was very like grassroots, organic. She started in her living room, you know, she always says, she started in her living room making really ugly jewelry. Like there, it was just total charity at the beginning, right? Like it was experimenting at the beginning, and they would take whatever beads that were given and donated. And then they'd try and put them together and go sell them back at church and, you know, that kind of thing. And then she's just really evolved and grown. And so it's been a real gift to be able to be a part of what she's doing there. And so, she and I basically, our timelines are similar. And so that's been interesting. Right. And then, this idea of preventing orphans is just kind of at the core of both of us. So it's been really a great part of our journey, my journey. And then we have an application online. We get groups that apply all the time to, in all different stages, you know, from I want to start an artisan group and I don't know what to do, to we have an artisan group and we've been doing this forever and we make these beautiful things and so on and so forth. So we are a small and mighty team at Trades of Hope. And so we cannot even work with everybody who applies. And it's funny because when we went to start Trades of Hope, we wondered, would there be enough groups? Like, could we get enough different products? And now it's really our priority to be long-term sustainable. And so we have been working with some of these same groups now since the very beginning. So for like Trades of Hope is going to be 15 years old later this year. And so well over 12, 13, 14 years, we've been working with most of these groups. And so, it's kind of like we're all growing up together.
I love that. How many countries are represented across the globe? So sorry for my voice.
No, that's okay. We have about 16 different countries that we work with. Kind of depends on the year, time of the year sometimes. We do a lot of Christmas decor from Nepal and things. And so, and some Easter stuff this year, which has been really fun and a fun addition. So it kind of ebbs and flows, but we have 26 artisan groups across the world really kind of working on different products at different times for us. And so we are already working on Christmas, and it is only March, April, and we are already working on Christmas. So that's pretty fun.
That is fun. I was also surprised to learn that you have a group, or at least one group, in the United States.
We do. We do. Yeah. We work a bit with Thistle Farms We love them and love what they're doing there. And then we at times are selling candles from Franciscan peacemakers in Wisconsin. And so, yeah, we're definitely open to that. And Hun's Honey in Baltimore. Yeah. So they work with, you know, people who are just transitioning into better lives and need a bit of help doing that. And so that's really beautiful, right? We all deserve second and third chances to create the lives that we're meant to have. So.
Absolutely. And the other thing, my voice is back. Yay. We'll take advantage of this. The other thing that, as you were talking about, you and Shelley and how you have the same common mission, same common heart for, you know, helping eliminate poverty orphans. I don't know exactly how you said it, but you have the same common mission, but you've also grown along together. It makes me think that in Trades of Hope, not only do you have partners, the artisan partners, but you also have partners who are helping their families. So I'd love to hear that side of the equation.
Yeah. Women like Melanie.
Yes, exactly.
Are the ones who are, you know, really being a voice and wearing and sharing the beautiful things that the artisan groups are making. You know, when we started Trades of Hope, we had to make a decision of what kind of business model we wanted this to be. And when you look historically at the very best parts of direct sales, there's some really beautiful, beautiful aspects of it. And I love that we get to work with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of women across the United States who can then, you know, create a little business of their own if they so chose. And be an advocate, because so many women, you know, they want to do good works. You hear of things like human trafficking and poverty orphans and, you know, multi-generational poverty and all these things. And we're busy moms, a lot of us, right? Mm-hmm. And we have jobs, we have kids, we have families. And so I love that Trades of Hope gives women a space in which they can really make a difference, really make a difference and a direct impact on alleviating poverty and human trafficking in our world. And they get to do it on their own time when they so choose to do it, you know, when it works for them. And so it's been a real gift for me. Like when people ask me, what's the biggest surprise you've had at Trades of Hope? I didn't know I needed, you know, hundreds of more friends, but apparently I did. And yeah, so we, some of the women who have been in Trades of Hope and been selling Trades of Hope alongside of us for the past 14 years, you know, have become my closest friends. And it's just really nice when you are in alignment and you are a group of people who have this common thread, this common desire to make an impact in the world. And you can be so different and you can come from different places and have different backgrounds and yet you come together and you're passionate about alleviating poverty orphans and human trafficking. I mean, that's really powerful. And it's really fun to walk alongside these women as they are working to on this big mission as well.
So important. And you mentioned the friends that you have in Trades of Hope. You also mentioned your sister, who you've worked alongside with, Shelley. So many deep and rich friendships. How, as a busy woman traveling all over with a family of your own, even though I know they're grown, it's a lot. What are a couple of things that have been helpful to you to nurture friendships that you would want to share with a woman listening who's like, okay, I am overloaded. I am working mom. I am just barely hanging on. What's mm-hmm. some encouragement that you give them around nurturing friendships?
Yeah, I believe so strongly in the importance of women having other friends and prioritizing that in your life. You know, I have several different groups of women who I spend time with and really carve time out. And we plan months and months in advance of when that time is going to be. And it's just the reality, like life hits hard sometimes. And these women add a lot of value to my life. They bring a lot of wisdom to my life and just love and support. And when, you know, the bad stuff happens, the sick kids or the divorces or the whatever, I mean, we need to be there for each other. And I also love, you know, Elizabeth, my oldest daughter, grew up seeing me spend two weekends a year going off with my girlfriends from high school. And now she prioritizes that in her life too, these other women, these relationships and these friendships, because friendships don't just hang around, right? And I think, you know, in the past, I had seen some women say to me, oh, I wish I could do that too, but I'm so busy. And, you know, whether family is really demanding, husbands, whatever, they just didn't think they could do it. And that might be the reality for some people, but I really like, if at all possible, I think just having these other relationships with other women in my life. I love my husband. He cannot be everything for me.
Yeah.
Nor should he, nor, you know, and for his sake, I shouldn't hope that he would be, you know? So I just don't even have the words to say how much value I think it brings when women stand together and love and support each other. I think that's where really beautiful things can happen in each other's lives and around us, and in trade, you know, in the aspect of Trades of Hope, all of those women coming together is just creating these beautiful ripples of change that I can't do by myself. You know, mm-hmm. Elizabeth can't do by herself. So it's been a true, true blessing.
Well said. I love it. Oh, Gretchen, I'm just meeting you, and I just feel like we have so much in common. It has been an absolute joy because you are a woman who has a big heart for women. You are a person who not only has the idea, but acts on it and invites others to join. And it's really, really beautiful to see what you are accomplishing in your life. And purely out of just a heart for families being unified and for mothers having opportunities to be the hero in their own story. And I'm just so honored to know you. And I thank you so much for joining me at the Common.
Thank you so much. I loved meeting you, and I hope we can stay in touch too.
Thank you for listening to The Commons with Carla. In each of these conversations, I hope you find inspiration. And I hope that you notice more of what you have in common with the women around you. As you ask questions, get to know their story, and share your own. Your story matters. If you enjoyed my conversation with Gretchen and want to hear more encouraging stories, please follow the show on Apple, Spotify, Overcast, or wherever you listen. Ratings and reviews are one way people find the podcast. If you'd be so kind as to leave a rating and review, that would be great. Thank you. And thank you to Adkins Media Co. for their work on the show, and to Donald Zimmerman for our theme music. That's it for this episode. In the words of Thomas Merton, love is our true destiny. We do not find the meaning of life by ourselves alone. We find it with another. Until next time, live and love with intention.